This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. On this Thursday, we check in with our reporters here in the region to find out about the stories they've put out in print and online. And we start out first with our conversation with Dan Carton. Dan's the chief political reporter with the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Dan, thank you for joining us here on the program today.
Happy to be here.
Well, we know that this election coming up on November 3rd is going to be one that people that go to the polls, or maybe they'll take a look at their ballots if they're getting the mail-in ballot, will take a look at not only, of course, candidates that are running for office, but their retention questions this time around. I guess last time we had questions if they lived in school districts that had referendum questions to be considered. Now we have, a retention question for just about everybody. And your story that was in the Times was very extensive going into what retention elections are all about. So I'll let you kind of explain things, and then we can take a look at the list and look at some of the candidates, or at least the officials that have asked to be retained in office. So go right ahead.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, everybody knows that the, you know, these big election races that are happening this year on the ballot for president, for governor, attorney general, a lot of local offices, state legislature. But one of the things that people tend to overlook is that the judicial retention elections are also going to be on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana has a unique system where the governor initially appoints state appellate-level judges and justices of the Indiana Supreme Court based on recommendations from a nonpartisan commission. And then Hoosiers don't have a say in the initial appointment, but their chance to weigh in on those judges and justices comes 2 years later when they are up for retention. They don't run against anybody. They're just on the ballot, and the question asks, should, you know, this judge or should this justice be retained on the court for a 10-year term? And then after 10 years, the judge or justice can run again for retention. And it's up to Hoosier voters to decide whether or not these judges and justices remain on the court based on, you know, after being appointed by the governor, or whether or not there should be a vacancy and a new judge or justice appointed.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did things get changed back in the 70s to make this a little different, and in particular, as far as the nominating commissions or the merit selection, I guess, however that you wish to put it, you put it in the story. How did this change around and into what we are doing today these days?
Yeah, prior to 1970, Indiana elected its Supreme Court justices. So they would run in a, you know, contested primary for political parties. There'd be the general election, there would be a Republican candidate for Supreme Court justice, Democratic candidate. They would face off, and the voters would decide who ended up on the court. In the, you know, leading up to 1970, when the Constitution was changed, it was thought that by switching to a merit selection system where a panel reviews the candidate, reviews applicants for the post, and recommends three of them to the governor, who then has to appoint one of those three, you'd get, let's say, higher quality justices. You know, anybody can win an election, as we've seen in recent years, and it's not always necessarily the best person for the job. In this case, you know, when the Hoosiers voted to change the Constitution because they believed maybe Indiana would be better served by having judges and justices at the appellate level who were the best people for the job, or who at least a nonpartisan commission and the governor thought were the best people for the job. So they took the election process out of the selection and switched it over to this merit selection process where, you know, you remove partisanship from the equation. Obviously, you know, you can't totally eliminate partisanship. The governor in this case is a Republican and, you know, has been in the state since 2004. So everybody applying for these vacancies knows, you know, you probably want to be a Republican if you're seeking the post, because that's who the governor is going to favor. But, you know, it's not unusual. There's been, you know, Democrats appointed to these courts, you know, by recent Republican governors, just
right,
because of sometimes where the appointment has to come from. So it's not unusual to see it. And in general, partisanship is far less of a consideration compared to having elected judges.
Now, we know they've had this for some time here with the appellate judges. As far as local judges are concerned, here in Lake County and here in the rest of Northwest Indiana, how are the judges selected, and will they see some sort of retention request on the ballot, we'll say locally here in Lake County or some of the other counties in the area?
Yeah, it's interesting. Indiana's most populous counties, Lake County, Allen County, Marion County, all have appointed judges. There is some controversy with this because those three counties also have the greatest number of minority residents. And there's some suggestion that that's designed to impede the appointment, having appointed judges to decide to impede minority voting and the potential election of minority judges through the election process. The counter argument is, you need a much more professional judiciary in counties with the most people because you're going to see the most cases, and you'd want to have the absolute best people rather than whoever can win in an election. So, Lake County is one of the three counties that does have appointed judges at the county level, except for the circuit court judge, which the Constitution requires be elected, but that's only one judge. And then all the rest of the counties in the state, all the other 89 counties, all have elected judges. So Lake County voters will see several judges listed for retention on this year's election, on this year's ballot. Other counties regularly elect their circuit and superior court judges.
Now, that's the reason why we saw for the Lake County election. That's why we saw Marissa McDermott's name on the ballot when she was running for Lake Circuit Court judge.
Yeah, it's a quirk of the Constitution that circuit court judges have to be elected, but superior court judges, which is most of the judges in all the counties, in Lake County are appointed. Most of the rest of the state are elected.
Okay. Now, I understand that the ballot this time, or I should say on the ballot this time, we're seeing only one Supreme Court member who is looking for retention this year. Tell us a little bit about Justice Christopher Goff and why we're seeing him on the ballot.
Yeah, so the constitutional change to a merit selection system requires the justices go before the voters at the election within 2 years of their appointment. So Justice Goff was appointed in 2017. He succeeded Justice Robert Rucker, who was a Gary native, well-known here in Northwest Indiana. The Gary Courthouse is named for Justice Rucker after he retired. So Governor Holcomb appointed Goff in 2017 after the Judicial Nominating Commission recommended him and two other candidates. 2020 is the first general election within 2 years of his appointment, so Goff is up for retention. So now is the chance for Hoosiers to decide whether or not they want to keep him on the bench for a 10-year term or whether they think perhaps he should be, he should not be retained and there should be a vacancy, and the governor elected this year will appoint a new justice.
Now, on the Indiana Court of Appeals, there are a number of judges, I guess, up for retention this year. And what of those are we likely to see some kind of impact here in Northwest Indiana if they get the retention as requested?
Yeah, so there's going to be four on the ballot in Northwest Indiana. There's kind of a quirky districting system for appellate court judges. Some serve specific parts of the state, others serve statewide. They all actually serve the entire state, but it's just how they end up on the court. So there's state altogether across the state, there's six of the 15 Court of Appeals judges are seeking retention this year. Four of them will be on the ballot in Northwest Indiana. Actually, only one of them is a first-time retention seeker.
Mm-hmm.
This is Judge Elizabeth Tavitas, who came from Lake County. She was a Lake County judge. Governor Holcomb appointed her to the appellate court in 2018. So, this is her 2-year period of serving as an appointed judge and then She'll be on the ballot this year for a 10-year term, and she is running for retention.
Now, I understand that as far as the Lake County Superior Court judges that you mentioned earlier here, that we have a number that are up for retention. Who is going to be noted on the ballot that just that yes or no, I guess, request that they're asking for? Who do we see? Are we going to see on the ballot this time?
Yeah, there's five Lake Superior Court judges: John Sadia, Nicholas Shirelli, Julie Cantrell, Sheila Moss, and Diane Ross Boswell, who are running for retention in Lake County. And you'll see their names on the ballot this year. And if you want to retain them, vote yes. If you want to reject them, vote no. And depending on the outcome of the election, we'll see who stays on the bench. They run for a six-year term, or they're up for a six-year term compared to the appellate judges who would get a 10-year term.
Now, as far as the state judges are concerned, has anybody not been retained through this merit selection process that you know of?
Right, yeah, that's what's interesting. So, you know, this has been 50 years of merit selection on Indiana's appellate courts, and no judge has ever been rejected. So everybody has always won their retention election. You know, that either suggests that governors are picking good judges and Hoosier voters are satisfied with them, which is exactly how the process is supposed to work, or, you know, it's just another thing at the bottom of the ballot that nobody's really paying attention to. And, you know, most of the time people don't know the Supreme Court justices or the Court of Appeals judges, so they have no reason to vote against them. So they either vote yes or, you know, maybe just leave it blank. But, yeah, it's interesting. So possibly the system's working perfectly, or possibly voters just don't care. We don't know.
We'll find out. We're talking with Dan Carton, who's the chief political reporter for The Times, on the stories that he's had out in print and online. One of the other stories that's out there is one that you recently put out about some action that was taken by some federal courts concerning some Hoosier laws on voter participation. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's been quite a few lawsuits filed this year in connection with this upcoming election, trying to expand voter participation or limit voter participation. You've seen that in Indiana and across the country. One of the sort of more interesting ones was a push to require the state send every voter a mail-in ballot, whether they request it or not. Indiana is one of six states where you have to have an excuse to vote by mail. That was waived in the primary election because the portions of the governor's state home order were still in effect. That largely has been lifted now. So the Republican governor, the Republican secretary of state, aren't pushing for no excuse absentee balloting for the general election. So you have to have one of these 12 excuses to get an absentee ballot. This group, Vote by Mail Indiana, tried to get a court order to require the state send everybody a ballot to allow them to vote by mail. The federal court in Indianapolis rejected that because the judge said that there is no constitutional right to vote by mail. You only have to have the ability to vote, on election day, or Indiana has made absentee voting, extremely easy. Mm-hmm. Nobody actually verifies your vote by mail excuse, and there's in-person early voting for 30 days before the election. So the judge said there's plenty of opportunities to vote. He rejected the request to, require the state send everybody a mail-in ballot. Now that case is being appealed to the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. They've kind of expedited the case because obviously the election is coming up. So we should probably see another ruling on this, possibly by the end of the month. So it's still out there as a potential, wrinkle in this year's election, but seems unlikely to pass legal muster.
Well, as we talk about people wanting to cast their ballots and how they can cast their ballots, the question still comes down to, if you don't register to vote, you can't cast a ballot. And that's one of the stories that you had out there talking about this reminder that there is a deadline coming up for voter registration. And give us what that reminder is, please.
Yeah, absolutely. October 5th. you need to register to vote by October 5th if you want to cast a ballot. The president talks about how this is the most important election ever. Democrats are eager, especially to get rid of President Trump. A lot of people are interested in the election, but if you don't register to vote, you can't vote. You can't vote by mail. You can't vote in person. You can't show up on election day and say you forgot. You have to register by October 5th, and you can do it online at indianavoters.com. If you have a driver's license or state ID card, it's incredibly easy. Or if you don't, you can go to your county government office, your county board of elections, your county clerk's office, and register in person there with an electric bill or bank statement or some other piece of mail that shows your address.
I know that that IndianaVoters.com, as you mentioned, is incredibly easy, and especially now since we have this major concern about being able to cast an absentee ballot, it's very easy to be able to request one now, too. You don't have to worry about getting back to the courthouse or to the voter registration office to make sure that they know that, hey, I want to see something in the mail.
Correct. Yeah, you can request it on the website. You can also track it on the website. It'll show when your ballot was mailed out from the county, and also whether the county has gotten your returned ballot back. So it makes it really easy to keep track of an absentee vote, or to even just verify that you are registered to vote. It's a good idea to go on IndianaVoters.com, check that out before the deadline to make sure if there's any problems or if you've moved recently, you need to register where you're living now. Mm-hmm. So. You know, it's easy to do online, and you can get everything taken care of.
That's all great news. And then when you get registered, so this way you make sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. If you want to actually feel that you can get out and do your early voting early and in person, that's going to be happening pretty soon too, I understand.
Yeah, early voting starts on October 6th. There's going to be almost a dozen locations in Lake County and some locations in Porter County and LaPorte County. You can go in person, cast your ballot, ahead of election day. So if you're concerned about crowds at the polls on election day because of COVID, you can go, anytime for the 30 days leading up to the election and vote in person and, get it taken care of.
Dan Carton is the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Some great stories here, all related to the upcoming elections. As always, thanks for joining us today, and we'll take note of some of these deadlines so this way we won't forget to vote when it's supposed to be time to vote. Thank you very much today.
Tis the season.
this is true. We may not see much as far as Christmas or the winter holidays are concerned, but we certainly have the political holidays to look forward to.
Absolutely.
That's for sure.
Thanks, time of the year.
Thanks very much. Talk to you again soon, I hope.
Sure.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On the program today, we have opportunities to get caught up on several of the major stories that have been in the Times in Northwest Indiana. We've heard from Dan Carton. Let's check now on the business scene. And for that, of course, we turn to Joseph Pete, who's the business reporter and writer for the Times. And as always, Joe, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Let's take a look first here. A lot of the stories I know you've had recently have focused on labor as well as business. And one in particular that you mentioned, had in your story that we want to mention first, is the one that talks about the concern not only that our labor force in Northwest Indiana have about getting back to work here in the pandemic, but also the fact that their bosses and the labor market in general is very, very concerned about the impact that the coronavirus has taken to us. Tell us about that story, please.
Yes. The coronavirus has taken a major toll on the labor market in Northwest Indiana, particularly in the particularly the heavy industry, the trades, but it's rippled really throughout the sector. You've seen mass layoffs. U.S. Steel had warned it could lay off as many as 3,700 steel workers at Gary Works in the Midwest plant. ArcelorMittal's temporary layoffs were more than 1,600. It terminated permanently more than 100 professional salaried employees. There have been thousands of layoffs at the casinos, at the Chicago assembly plant just across the state line, the Chicago stamping plant, Lear. A lot of the manufacturing operations have been displaced entirely by the, earlier this year in the spring when the pandemic was named a global pandemic in March. And then you've since seen people trickle back to work. The steel mills have been bringing blast furnaces back online and recalling laid off workers. Most of the ones were temporary, but some of the ones, the casino in Michigan City, for instance, Blue Chip, said the disruption could result in layoffs of as much as like 40% of its workforce. So you've seen these mass layoffs, most of which were originally intended to be temporary, but no one knew how long this thing was going to last or that it was going to persist. You know, with, now we're in September with more than 190,000 Americans have been killed by coronavirus. The unemployment had reached, it was much higher than during the Great Recession, much higher throughout the early, and it's been going back down, but in July it was still at 10.6%, which is not, it's never great to have double-digit unemployment statewide, especially since in Northwest Indiana we do tend to have a little bit higher unemployment than the rest of the state. Given our economy here is heavily industrialized, then you kind of have the boom-bust cycle with a lot of the, like either it's feast or famine for the mills. But the there's been a ripple effect, though, in the slowdowns in manufacturing, because Northwest Indiana is also home to very robust trades unions and skilled tradesmen, and then or tradespeople, and they have been working. You know, they work on a number of projects, construction, and new buildings, highways, infrastructure, so on. But one of kind of the biggest areas is the project. You know, they spend millions and millions of dollars on projects at the steel mills and the oil refinery every year. And that is pretty much, unfortunately, dried up. You have, a lot of the boilermakers and other specialized workers have kind of been, you know, stuck at home filing for unemployment. The mills aren't, or the unions, the trade halls aren't taking new apprentices. It's just been a general slowdown. They're hoping for it to come back next year. They're saying Northwest Indiana Building Construction Trades Council business manager Andy Palmatier had said it's unlike anything they'd ever seen before. They still do have a couple projects that are still going. The Hard Rock Casino in Gary is still a big, there's still hundreds of people out working on that. But like other bigger projects that have been made for employers, such as the Klein Avenue Bridge replacement, it was going strong at first, but then, you know, it ultimately ended up being shut down. And it's just, it's been kind of famine out there for a lot of the workers. And, you know, a lot of people are still, a lot of workers are unfortunately still home or working reduced hours or, you know, seeing their income decrease. And it's a lot of people have just been struggling throughout this pandemic.
I know in the story that we're referring to here and some of the other stories as well that you've had in the Times, in this big story that had come out, you had a chance to talk with IU Northwest economist Micah Pollack, and he offers some very interesting things to think about and concerns because we know about the overall view of the unemployment rate and how things have changed slightly. But there are some systemic problems you mentioned in the story that we probably should not forget about also. Tell us about the concerns that Professor Pollack had about the labor market in general here.
Oh, absolutely, yes. It is, we've seen issues. One thing he's often pointed out over the years is, you know, we used to have a very robust manufacturing sector that paid, you know, very good wages. And, you know, that was often the backbone of the area. It allowed a lot of people, often new immigrants from all over the world, come and earn the American dream, be able to afford a home, maybe even like a boat, put their kids through college and so forth. But, you know, we've seen a lot of those high paying jobs have been disappearing and they've been replaced with these lower paying service industry jobs. And then it's kind of being exacerbated by this while the job market has been improving in recent years. Like his concern is that a lot of that is that people are working at jobs well below their education and skill level. They're kind of juggling multiple part-time jobs. They're doing gig economy jobs, such as for Uber or Lyft or delivering DoorDash or, you know, that type of thing. Or they're doing entry-level jobs. And so while technically some people are employed currently, they're, you know, profoundly underemployed. They're not making what they could be making, what their skill level, you know, suggests they should be making. And that kind of the rise of these like lower paying jobs has been kind of a bane on the economy locally because it has a ripple effect because, you know, it'd been like if you're running a restaurant or a small business, you know, you want people to be relatively well off and to be able to come in and buy their family dinner. You know, the consumer spending takes a hit when the only jobs available are kind of like lower paying ones. And his concern is, though, like the overall unemployment number has been going down, where it's not really going down because we're getting like new jobs. You know, the refinery's cutting jobs. The steel mills have been cutting jobs. Ford is like now announced they're slashing 1,400 white collar jobs. Like a lot of the good paying jobs are just unfortunately just vanishing. And, you know, it's a drag on the labor market and just the overall economy of Northwest Indiana. It's not a problem unique to Northwest Indiana, but it's pretty pronounced here given our industry mix.
We're talking with Joseph Pete, who's the business writer and reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about the stories that he's put out in print and online. One in particular, when you had a chance to focus in on a business or industry that has done very well, and especially one that is locally based. It's nice to see these stories. Tell us about your story that you entitled Enterprise of the Year. We're talking in this case about the business that we've had to feature on, regionally speaking, too, about CIMCOR.
Oh, absolutely, yes. They're called Enterprise of the Year because the Times Business Industry Hall of Fame, every year it inaugurates kind of legends of Northwest Indiana business, people like, you know, Dean White or Jeff Strack or prominent business figures who have contributed greatly to the local economy. This year, the Enterprise of the Year was named CIMCOR in Merrillville, a very impressive, successful firm that's worked with they do security or cybersecurity software. They've worked with some major clients, including the Department of Defense, many federal government agencies, Cornell University, the Milwaukee Brewers. And there was a timely news hook, which is why they're recognized this year as the Enterprise of the Year, is because they have been, for the past couple of years, they've been working with Zoom, which has really skyrocketed as a platform, you know, during this whole coronavirus pandemic. You've seen jokes like Skype blew a 3-1 lead or a 28-3 lead over it, but Zoom has really been widely adopted as the way people have been staying connected throughout the entire, throughout COVID-19 in this era of social distancing. And it has been, they've done it with the help of Robert Johnson and the cybersecurity, the SimTrack cybersecurity that CIMCOR has provided. They're based out in Merrillville. They're out by the South Lake Mall on the other side of the interstate. It's just kind of an unassuming office building. You know, they're maybe not the biggest employer or anything, but they have are very relevant in a tech age. They're really helping organizations, banks really, and credit card providers like all over the world, protect their customers from hacking, and they're helping companies big and small all over both protect their networks and also protect their customers, protect their data, and or comply with the cybersecurity regulations, which can be complicated, because you have to do it at the federal level. And then for a lot of these multinational businesses, they have to follow different cybersecurity rules for the European Union, for, you know, the United States of America, for the Asian markets, and so on. And this is really a company with global reach that is helping people like the Department of Defense keep their data safe. And at a time when hacking is, like, you know, mounting exponentially all across the globe, you've seen instances where, you know, they just busted that 16-year-old kid for promoting Bitcoin by hacking into the Twitter accounts of many prominent people like Elon Musk and Kanye West. And, you know, really any teenager with a keyboard these days could, corrupt the systems of some of the largest organizations in the world. And then we have a company, a homegrown company right here in Merrillville that has been defending against that threat.
Well, Joe, we're going to have to leave it at that for now, but we'll have to have an opportunity here. Take a look in the Times at the Joseph Pete story here concerning CIMCOR and the other businesses that have very quietly been making good in the region. And we thank you, as always, for spending time with us to talk about them today, Joe.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking. Well, it's no secret that plastic waste is everywhere. Plastic pollution, unfortunately, is everywhere, too. In fact, it has become one of the most important and foremost environmental issues that are affecting ecosystems and communities everywhere, including Northwest Indiana. And we have a new study from Valparaiso University with one of our guests coming up to talk about the research that's been done into it and how it has seemed to have affected Porter County. We are talking today with Valparaiso University environmental chemistry professor Julie Peller, along with Ron Taylor. He is the public education coordinator for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. And Ron and Professor Peller, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having us.
Well, Professor Peller, I'll let you lead things off. Your study with your research team of environmental chemistry students looking into, I guess, measuring and categorizing plastic waste that seems to have gotten into the Porter County environment. Tell us what prompted you and your team to get to work on such a project. Where'd you go to find all this plastic waste that's out there and some of the problems that apparently Porter County is dealing with?
Yeah, I think this is widespread, as you mentioned. Really what sort of initiated this idea for work with my environmental chemistry class this past semester was my own personal experiences with having some both dirt delivered to my house and retrieving dirt from the compost pile that Porter County has available. And I've been researching plastics, especially microplastics, for the last several years, so I guess my eye is a little bit more cued into it than the average person.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just shocked at how many tiny little plastic waste particles were part of the dirt that was delivered by a company and also by what I found at the compost pile. So I decided to look into this a little bit more and create a project for my students. And one of the first things that I did was to literally take a tour at the compost area and look into what materials were mostly used to create that compost, and found out that by and large it was the leaf collection, and people leave their leaves at the edge of their property. Usually right along the street area, so it seemed to me there was definitely a connection between what kind of plastic waste is out in our street area, our communities, and what ends up in the compost pile. So while our leaves nicely break down into the soil that we all like to put into our gardens, all that plastic does not. We know that it does not biodegrade, and therefore, we're seeing that from year to year, there's more of it out there simply because it continues to accumulate. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the reason behind initiating this project. And so literally last January, I sent my students out in pairs and said, go out in the community and, find the waste along the street. And of course, most of it's plastic, but I said, pick up what you have. They took a bucket, came back, and we started categories and that. We took samples from the compost pile and analyzed both of the sets of samples and made some comparisons there.
What types of plastics did you and your research team find, I guess, among all the various types? I know that we look at typically the codes are 1 to 7. That's what most recyclable plastic, at least, it comes in as. What did you find that you found out there? What were seemed to be the most abundant variety of plastics that you all collected?
Not surprising. We found that most of it was of the packaging type of plastic. We have so much of this one-use plastic that's part of our everyday life. And a lot of it just, whether we want it to or not, it just doesn't necessarily make it into the waste stream as it's supposed to, whether it's into the garbage or into the recycling. This is lightweight material that kind of takes off into our environment, and there's just a lot of it out there, a lot of that packaging type of plastic.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ron Taylor, are you finding in the collections that come in through the recyclers that provide support for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District, that this is the type of plastic that seems to be the most prevalent that's out there, not only the containers that the contractors pick up, but you're finding out there at the drop-off sites?
I can't speak necessarily to which recycling code most of the plastic falls into, but, mm-hmm. Obviously the this is, particularly the single-use plastics are pose a pretty serious problem for recycling streams. Those are the ones that are not
typically very suitable to be churned into new materials over and over again. They're not suitable for curbside bins or drop-off recycling. So those pose a very serious problem for recycling programs.
Now, Dr. Peller, are you finding that in the collections and the analysis that you all did within the project that we have this issue of single-use plastics, I guess is what it's called, and this is obviously what you're finding in the compost. I guess it's not supposed to be there, getting mixed in with all the compostable materials. Are we finding that this is just something that we, at least you feel, that have to be more diligent and make sure that it doesn't get mixed in to begin with?
Yeah, I think, as you mentioned, This is a huge environmental problem, and I think that there are many facets of the solution that we need to address, and certainly this is one of them. When I did take the tour at the Porter County site last winter, I was informed that they actually had people that worked along where the composting takes place to pull out a lot of the big pieces of plastic, so there is some effort to remove that from the compost, and that's good to know, but the bottom line is we still find quite a bit of it in there, and it really is just polluting that type of environment.
Fortunately, if you've ever been to the compost site, you can actually see it is a major undertaking that our staff does work at to remove, you know, the chunks of plastic from the materials that are brought in.
Well, it sounds like there's obviously a lot more than you want to begin with. Shouldn't have any at all. That's actually that would be the ideal. But apparently it's a case of these just things that end up in the compost because people happen to sweep them off to the side of the road. And, of course, the machinery come by and pick up the leaves or whatever other material that would go to the compost site.
Right. So, you know, when, you know, leaves, stuff that's just, you know, blown into the street, unfortunately, when that stuff gets picked up, when it's, you know, transported, you get all kinds of materials that you do not want in your compost. You don't want out in the environment. Unfortunately, that all can get kind of concentrated when it's all brought to the compost site.
Mm-hmm. Now, Professor,
and again, you know, our staff works very hard to get, you know, the big chunks of it, the big visible chunks. But unfortunately, as Julie stated, The problem with the plastic is that it doesn't biodegrade, but it breaks down into these progressively tinier and tinier pieces that are very difficult to get out of the environment. It's not impossible.
And I guess we're at the point, though, now not only are we supposed to really be recycling as we can, but we're also trying to reduce the amount of waste that we throw out, but also kind of rethinking and reusing what we are tossing out. Do you think that these are the guidelines that we need to follow these days to try to keep the plastic not only out of the waste stream, but also out of the compost piles?
Yeah, so we really try to emphasize reducing and reusing simply because, you know, recycling, what we traditionally think of as recycling and like what goes in your curbside bin, that is a very, very important piece of the puzzle, but it's just one small part of the overall effort we have to undertake to try to tackle plastic pollution. Recycling, as we've seen recently, unfortunately can be dependent on things like international markets, what other countries are doing. That can sometimes stymie our efforts to have really broad recycling programs and can be very dependent on things that we don't always have control over as a local community. Reducing and reusing, that involves behaviors and activities that are a little more under our control as households, as a local community. We can make decisions to, for example, simply buy less plastic, avoid those single-use plastics, things like plastic forks and spoons and drink cups that are not recyclable. We can make decisions that are much more under our control to avoid purchasing those kinds of things in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that's where the reducing and reusing comes in to sort of supplement the recycling that we do.
Now, Professor Peller, you've gotten this project with your students in environmental chemistry off and running, and you've gotten some results from this. Might there be any other projects related to this coming up in some of the future classes?
Definitely, and I'd like to also mention that it was interesting viewing this problem through the eyes of my students who are living in a different generation. They're much younger than me, so what they've experienced has just been normal to them. And so I think part of the problem, as Ron mentioned, we all have to recognize how much plastic we use and recognize that when we see it on the street, that's not good. It's going to end up somewhere in our environment if we're not cleaning this up and if we're not paying attention. And sometimes when I talk to young people, my concern is that that's just normal for them, seeing all this garbage that's out there, seeing plastic bottles, plastic bags flying in the wind, stuff in bushes and trees, that this has become normal for them. And that's something we need to work on to create an understanding that this is not normal and this is harmful to our environment. As I mentioned, my research has been exploring more of the microplastics.
Mm-hmm.
And recently we got some funding through the National Science Foundation and working with a colleague and collaborator at California State University, and we're using radiation techniques to study how this plastic weathers over time. We know that it's not biodegradable, but it does undergo, some very, very, there's small changes over a very long time. So over the course of decades, we're finding that the plastic does start conforming a little. It doesn't go away, but it's undergoing some changes. And so that's kind of what is on the horizon for the work that I'm doing with mostly with my research students at this point.
Julie Peller is a professor of environmental chemistry at Valparaiso University, and she and her students earlier this year, back in February of this year, did a research project finding out more about the plastic waste that somehow or another has found its way into Porter County's environment. And Ron Taylor is the public education coordinator for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. He's been working, of course, to do the best as the other staffers at the district to keep the plastics that can be recycled to go to the proper places. And try and keep it out of the composting pile. And thank you both for being with us here to talk about this topic today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us today and for this week. And our thanks to Dan Carden and to Joe Pete from the Times of Northwest Indiana for the stories that they've told us about that are in printed online. And thank you if you've spent time during the program to show your support for Lakeshore Public Radio programs. You still can. LakeshorePublicRadio.org/give.